What's up, Beardos? You're listening to a very special bonus episode of The Bearded Vegans.
Basically, our whole philosophy boils down to don't be a jerk.
Don't let me answer your question first by not answering your question. I really hope people didn't tune in to hear us talking about beards.
Beards.
What does that mean, Paul?
The big beans and the big brown ripple.
Who knows, Andy? I don't know.
Welcome to the show. We are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan. If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes at thebeardedvegans.com, and you can always reach us by emailing thebeardvegans@gmail.com. In today's episode, I am going to be interviewing a very special guest, the one, the only, Professor Paul Steller. Now, you might be asking, why is this interview happening? Well, we recently hit our third milestone on Patreon, which allows us to get 3 episodes a month transcribed. So that is pretty awesome. But also, if you're paying attention to the Patreon, you'll notice there's little promises that happen at each of these milestones. And so every time we're able to afford to get another episode per month transcribed, we're also going to do 2 bonus episodes in whatever month that happens. And we have been teasing for quite some time that it would be fun to do episodes in which we both interview each other. And we thought, this seems like the perfect time to do that. So one, if you are someone that has helped contribute to that, which you definitely are if you're listening, because this is a Patreon only thing at the moment, thank you very much for that, because it really helps us out. And we use this money to, we just upgraded our equipment, we pay for the transcriptions, we cover lots of costs that are associated with the podcast, and we're also able to donate some of it to some very worthy causes. So thank you for that. I think without further ado, I think I should just bring on my special guest. You might know him from the Bearded Vegans podcast and teaching math at both a high school and college level. Paul Steller, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Andy. How are you doing? Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
I've been wanting to get you on for such a long time. I'm glad that we could finally make that happen.
Man, these cicadas outside, really loud. Hopefully not being picked up in these beautiful new microphones.
Yeah. I mean, I'll actually be kind of stoked if the microphones are so good to pick them up crisp and clear.
Ambiance.
Even though it's like the opposite of why we upgraded all of our equipment. Wow, that is really loud. So hopefully that comes down. Damn.
That's been going since the last bonus episode we recorded.
Okay. Yeah, this is episode 2 of 3 that we are recording today, all of which are bonus episodes. So all of the Patreon backers will reap those benefits and almost nobody else. So, Paul, I'm feeling like a lot of pressure to be like an engaging interviewer right now. And I feel like interviewing is not really my strong suit. And normally when we go into interviews, it's because I'm like, this person's interesting. They offer perspective that neither of us can offer. And I have a specific thing that I want to talk to them about. And maybe they have a few projects that we'll get into. But this is just like creating something out of nothing, because I feel like I know so much about you already.
That's true.
And we've had literally hundreds of hours of conversations where we get to know each other and discuss all these things. But I think this could be a really good place for the listeners to learn more about you and like the things that are just totally off topic and have nothing to do with like our vegan discussions.
Mm-hmm.
However... Mm-hmm. You know the first question I always have to ask you, Paul.
I do, and I did not prepare for it.
So, Paul,
mm-hmm.
Tell me about transitioning to veganism. Like, what was your life like? What would that transition look like? How'd the people in your life react? Where were you at? What does that journey look like for you?
Well, I think I've been very fortunate, because I've had a very supportive family in many regards, and especially that rings true for my transition to veganism as well. And I'm also fortunate because I grew up in a family where I didn't eat as much meat as the typical American family, I would say. So my dad has been vegetarian for like 50 years, and my mom doesn't eat like certain types of meat. So I think just growing up, I ate less meat than the standard American household anyways.
How would you define like less meat?
Like
not every meal, or
yeah,
like
I would say not every meal,
or...
maybe, I don't know, four times a, like for like we would probably for dinner, there would be maybe some chicken dish, but then there would also be some days they were just be a vegetarian entree. And certainly it wasn't like an excess amount of meat, I would say.
I knew your dad's been vegetarian for a while. I didn't realize he was holding it down for 50 years.
I'm just throwing that number out there because it sounds right. It's truly a long time.
Should I go interview Ken Stellar instead?
No, because it was when he started when he was in the Navy, and that was when he was in his early 20s, and he's in his early 70s now. So I would say, yeah, 50 years.
It does sound like you'd be the more interesting interview. Vegan and vegetarian in the Navy?
Yeah. I can tell you right now, he went vegetarian because the food was gross. That is why he went vegetarian, and he has not turned back since then.
You know, it's funny because that's not too dissimilar from our good friend Doomy Bay's story about going vegan while in prison, and that like a lot of it was just because the food was gross and like tearing apart chicken legs that were undercooked was like really gross. So yeah. I guess that we just have to work on getting non-vegan food to be more gross and we can have a vegan world.
It already is gross. Yeah. So I ate less meat. And when I was in high school is when I started going to punk rock and hardcore shows. Andrew. And can I call you Andy? Are we formal enough?
Only my parents and authority figures call me Andrew, so please call me Andy.
and going to some of those shows, I started interacting with other people who were also vegan or vegetarian or just in general politically minded, which had a big influence on me in terms of how I perceived social justice issues. There was a lot of things that I had never thought about before, things that I was aware about, but didn't really think much about. And one of those things was veganism and vegetarianism. And so I decided, and because of that, I decided to go vegetarian when I was, I think, a sophomore in high school, or sophomore or junior in high school. And then I didn't think much about it. After that, I was like, yeah, this is cool. I'm doing the thing. It was easy, relatively easy for my family to adhere to that because they already had a vegetarian in the family. And then when I was a senior in high school, I was dating someone that was vegan, and I just decided over the summer, I was like, all right, when I go to college, I'm just going to go full vegan. So I remember there was this one pizza place near my house that made square pizzas, which for some reason I always thought tasted better simply because of the square shape of them. And
well, it's the same reason why they make White Castle burgers square. It's because there's nowhere for the flavor to hide.
Is that what they say?
I think so.
You should be a PR person for
trademark that.
nowhere for the flavor to hide. And so I remember before I moved to, I went to the University of Connecticut, before I moved to UConn, I ate at this pizza place one last time, and I was like, oh, this is some good ass vegetarian pizza. And then I moved into UConn, and I was like, this is it. Now I'm vegan. And I will also say, like, I've just been fortunate in many regards, in many aspects of my life, and some would say every aspect of my life. and veganism, because of my family, and also because UConn is extremely vegan friendly, I would almost exclusively eat at, they had 6 or 7 dining halls, and I would eat at this one dining hall that had a good vegan entree every single meal, not just some like bogusness. Like, it was good dishes, and I met a lot of friends there because other vegans ate there too. So I met a lot of other cool friends that I'm still friends with today. So I'd say that's it.
It's very on brand with you, with the final meal being pizza.
Yeah.
Did they have square pizza at UConn?
I don't think so. Unfortunately.
Bummer.
You know, it's square pizza though. 20th Street Pizza, newest hotspot in Philadelphia.
You know, I know this is your interview, but I don't think I told you that I went there recently.
Oh yeah?
It's pretty good. I wouldn't say noticeably better than Black Bear.
What? It's like that like cafeteria style pizza, you know?
Yeah, nothing says gourmet pizza like cafeteria style.
But it's so good. Anyways, continue, Andy.
No, it was good. It was good. I did like that I could get garlic knots.
Yes,
they were very garlicky. So, Paul, okay. I do want to talk about like the music scene, but I feel like maybe we should get this out of the way because I feel like this origin story might actually be contained within the music scene section of this interview. But I get asked this question a lot, and I actually don't have an answer for it. And we were also recently asked this by Trini Vegan on Instagram. How did we meet?
Oh, I think I know this. I think I purposely excluded some of this from my vegan origin story because I knew another question about this would probably come into play. So listener, you'll get more about Andy in part two of this interview series, but Andy was in a very successful ska band, and they were one of, if not my favorite band when I was probably a junior and senior in high school. And I was obsessed with this band to the extent, I think this might be new information for Andy. You know how, do you remember AIM, AOL Instant Messenger?
Uh-huh.
You know how you could create like a little avatar? Like you could have like a little picture that was your guy. And uh-huh. And you could even get like little early GIFs. Like you can have little like animated things. And you know, do you remember the AOL guy was like a little, it's not a stick figure because it was just like a round circular head and then like kind of like a,
like the yellow body.
Yes, yes, the yellow body. Yeah. And a lot of people would like make characters with that. I made an animated Flaming Tsunamis AOL GIF thing that I made my picture.
What was the GIF?
It was like all the different members of the band. You each had your own individual one. And then there was a shot where it was like all the band members. And because it
were
was
we
like
skanking.
Well, the animation wasn't that good, but it was just like bouncing up and down basically.
That's amazing. I did not know that. I thought you were about to like reveal you had a tattoo of the band or something like that.
No. No, something far worse than that. I made an AOL GIF when I was sophomore, junior in high school. But oh, anyways, this is how we met. So like I was alluding to, that I met a lot of people, or I knew a lot of people in the music scene that were vegan or vegetarian, and Andy was one of those people. And you, the person that's interviewing me, you've talked about this on the podcast before, but I like explicitly remember when you would make like chili in a slow cooker and bring it to the shows and stuff like that, and have little, you know, it's just like these subtle ways of promoting veganism. And it definitely like really stuck with me. And I feel like you were like a big role model for me in the music scene. And then that progressed over time to being like a vegan role model. And I think, I guess we're just talking about when we met. So I could gush on about Andy all day, but
go on.
So at some point, I grew the guts to, I grew more guts, and I
the boy is full of guts.
I friended Andy on Facebook. We were probably, did you have a MySpace? I'm sure we were.
I did have a MySpace.
Okay, maybe we were friends on MySpace too, but I specifically remember because I friended you on Facebook, and I think we would like see each other at house shows and stuff. And I would maybe like be like, oh, hey. And maybe like at the most, I'd probably give you the nod. That's probably the extent of our interactions. And then after I went vegan, this is definitely my freshman year of high school, Andy put up a Facebook status that said, hey, can anyone help me sell these t-shirts for Compassion Co. at the, I believe it was the Worcester Veg Fest, and when it was in like the hangar,
mm-hmm.
right? It was in like a plane. Place,
yeah, was that a
you
library?
Weren't there, but
well, that was weird because you could tell the story. It's your interview.
Yeah, so Andy was like, I need someone to help me out with selling t-shirts. Will anyone help me out? And I was like, cool, I'm newly vegan, and also this person is my idol. So yes, I will. I responded. I said, I'm happy to do it. And then so I went over to Andy's apartment, and he showed me around. You had like that little closet in that like attic-y type
in?
Thing. I don't think that was the room you lived in, that like extra room. Did you live in that room? That was like a slanted
room. Yeah, I lived in that room. I lived in, was that when I was living with Michelle?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like dating someone and living in that apartment. And then like we broke up, and then more specifically, I was broken up with and moved out. And then like through other circumstances, ended up moving back in with a totally different set of people. But every time, even when I've lived with this one partner, is the only partner I've ever lived with. This is my interview now. we always had separate bedrooms.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's traditional like that. the same room, just separate beds.
Like a 1950s sitcom. Yeah. And this room was like supposed to be like a laundry room. And but my bed fit perfectly like right under this like slanted ceiling. There's like one outlet that was like a laundry machine like outlet hookup or whatever.
Not a lot of headspace, if I remember.
No, I actually loved it because it was really good for like putting your legs up on the slanted ceiling. Oh, and nice. Like stretching your legs in the morning. No light got into that room whatsoever. And that room was finished. And then off of that was an unfinished piece of the attic. The whole thing was a third floor apartment on the top floor. And that's where I had all of my bins and all of my yes. shirts for Compassion Co.
So I specifically remember going there and Andy showing me like, okay, this is all this stuff. This is what you're going to do. This is what you're going to do, blah, 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 blah. And then I went and did the dang thing. Again, Andy was not there, but I went and did the thing. And then I think just the next time you needed someone, you were like, hey, I don't want to teach a new person how to do this stuff again because it's annoying. Will you do this again? Maybe that's not what you said. That's probably what you were thinking. I know you, Andrew.
Well, I think I must have been on the 10 Billion Lives tour because Michelle was doing a lot of VegFest.
Yeah.
And so I was like recruiting help for her. So you did multiple VegFest without me before
Oh, really?
We ever did one together. Yeah.
Huh.
Like, I think you probably did Boston with her.
Probably, yeah. And then I did one with Josh, and that's how I that's how I met Josh too. But
oh, really?
Yeah, that's how I met Josh.
Yeah, that's funny because I never you're like two great friends of mine, and I never really knew how you two came into each other's lives
either. It's because we did the Boston Veg Fest together at some point. This was like a year or two after that, though. I think I was a seasoned pro at the setting up those terrible screen things, shirt displays. Were you gonna say something?
I was gonna make a joke, but. The time is
but yeah, so that's how I met Andy. Is we just I started helping him out with these. I mean, that's not how we met, but that's how we became good friends.
Because people ask me that question. That's almost like it's not a first date question, but it's like a hanging out with friends that you don't really know that well. They'll be like, oh, so how did you meet your podcasting partner?
Yeah,
and I'm always like, I don't really know, like the moment, like we were kind of music scene together, and then I asked, you know, for help, and then just through that we kind of, you know, grew closer, I guess, and became like friends that would actually talk and not just nod at each other. But I never knew like if there was like a moment when there was like, hi, we're friends now, or if it was just, you know.
Yeah, and I think even like after that, I don't know how much we like hung out.
Like not much.
Not much. But I specifically remember we both went to see Converge one time and in New Britain. And
Hard hitting.
And I remember like talking to, like, I don't know why I have this memory in my head. I think it's because I had just gone to this. There was like at UConn, some philosophy guy came to the campus and specifically talked about philosophically why we should eat animals. And I remember I was like, oh, I really want to talk about this with Andy. And so I specifically remember going to the show after that and hanging out with you, but I remember us not being like hangout friends yet. But then, yeah, somehow we became hangout friends. And then definitely starting this when I decided to, I wanted to do a podcast about veganism. Andy was like the first person that came to my mind. Cause I was like, no one knows more about veganism than Andy. So, yeah. And then we became, I would say best friends.
The best of friends.
Yes.
That's true.
It was the best of friends. It was the best of friends.
It was only the best. Yeah, I was actually going to ask this later, but, since you said it now, I'll transition flawlessly and not draw attention to that transition by asking, like, when you asked me to do that podcast, did you have any idea how much work it was going to end up being? Or that it would still be happening 4 years later?
Yeah, definitely not the 4 years later thing. I definitely underestimated. Yeah, I think, you know, I was currently at that time, we had just started doing a podcast, myself and my brother and some of our other friends. We had just started doing a Dungeons and Dragons podcast, and that was like a lot of work for a different reason, mostly because the sessions we would record would be really, really long. And sometimes I'd be like, oh, I don't feel like having to do this thing for 5 hours at a time. Even though it was fun and it was great and I had a great time, and I'm sad that I don't still do it. But yeah, I think the this podcast is such a different thing. And even though I feel like at this point we're in a good, I feel like we have a good routine down. But I think it took a while to get that routine down. And still, I mean, there are still times that come up where it's like, we know, like, wow, this episode is going to take a lot of work to put together. And then I say, good luck with that, Andy.
What do you think is the hardest thing about doing the podcast?
I think the hardest thing for me is probably the time thing for a couple reasons. One, because I don't have a lot of free time. And I feel like since we've started this podcast, I've gone through like various life changes in terms of having like a demanding teaching job to having some pretty like more laid back jobs to then studying for school and applying to schools and now being in school. And kudos to Andy for staying consistent through it all. My rock.
The rock.
and just so the amount of time that it takes, we've kind of has been like an issue for me at various times. And I like the other thing I was going to say about this is like, I do wish that I could spend more time on it sometimes when I'm like, oh, I know Andy is doing a lot of work for this right now. And I am just like, I just can't put any more in it. And especially since I started school where it's just now I'm doing something that's already very mentally taxing and time demanding. And then it's like to then like, there are days when I finish going to classes and stuff like that. And I'm like, I don't want to think about anything. And I don't want to do anything that takes like energy. And on those days, I literally will come home. I will make myself food and I will just watch The Office for like an hour, which has become, I know that's like the joke of 2019 is everyone watches The Office, but it's literally like, it's this thing. And it could be another show too, but it's this thing where it's like, I don't have to think too hard about, I don't have to think at all about this thing. I can just kind of put it on the background and zone out because my brain is just sometimes so fried. But I look forward to, which I'm sure I assume there's going to be questions about this, about my post school or just about school. I look forward to not being in school so that I can have a more, for many reasons, so that I can have a more consistent lifestyle where I'm like, okay, I know how much is demanded of me on average every single week. And so I can kind of be like, okay, now I have this amount of time and this energy that I can put towards the podcast that can be more consistent, both because I think it would help the quality of the podcast, but also so that I could give Andy some relief for all the tremendous amount of work that he does.
I look forward to that day, Paul. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about school. I put the call out online for people to ask questions, and a few people did ask math questions of you. But before we even get any specifics, I asked you this once on a car ride because it's fun to ask people about like what they're passionate about. But for those that were not privy to that two-person conversation, math is your thing. Like, why math? What about math is so interesting to you to the point where you want to go to school for it and be sort of consumed by it and potentially have like a career in that in the future?
That's a great question, Andy. I think when I was teaching high school, like the first day or the first couple of days of classes where you're just kind of introducing yourself and getting to know your students, one of the things that I tried to do as well was to start to be like, this is why math is great and this is why we should study math. And the things that I would basically try to tell them was, I was like, one, math is just everywhere. Like every single thing that we interact with, like every single thing that we interact with that has been created by humans has some mathematical background to it. It's like everything that has been created, there was some reason why some engineer somewhere decided these are the specifications of why these dimensions are going to be this way, and to maximize or minimize the amount of material or the amount of space, minimize the amount of material, stuff like that. It's like everything has so meticulously been created and all of that stuff has math behind it, whether it's like if we're talking about applied math, Then it's like engineering and physics and chemistry and all these things. It's like, these are all things that are based in math and require math to do. So from a practical standpoint, it's like math is literally everywhere, and not just in stuff we've created, but in terms of nature. And it's like, and this kind of leads to my second reason why I love math so much, is because I think that math is beautiful. And that's a thing that, like, Andy's smirking at me right now.
I'm not smirking. I'm smiling in adoration.
Like, that's a thing that even as I say it, I'm like, this sounds corny. But if you ask almost any other person that's also studying math, they'll be like, oh, yeah, of course, math is beautiful. Like, of course, that makes sense. And it's just, it's this thing that it just, it works out in these ways where you're like, this stuff shouldn't work out. And it's actually the reason. It's been used, some specific math stuff has been used to be like, oh yeah, of course God exists because look at this math thing. And like, and there's no reason why this thing should be happening. And it's like these things where you're like, is this a, like, this can't be a, surely this can't be a coincidence. There's no reason why something like this should be happening. Like an easy example would be, the golden ratio or the golden spiral, which is the golden ratio is just a number. It's like 1.61 blah, 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 or something like that. And it's an irrational number, which means it goes on forever. It doesn't repeat. There's no pattern to it. It just goes on forever. It's just some number. It's no more special than the number 3 or the number 17 over 50, whatever. It's just some number.
How dare you disparage 17 over 50 like that, Paul?
The least special number. But for some reason, this number, this golden ratio, one, it just happens to show up in a lot of places. If you look at, like, a lot of people are familiar with the golden spiral, which is just, it looks like a spiral kind of, but it has very specific specifications about, like, its dimensions. But that shape of that spiral is the shape that, like, galaxies spiral in. And it's also the shape that if you look at a sunflower, the way that the little seeds inside are arranged, it's the same exact shape. And it's just this number that shows up in all these places in nature, but then also it shows up a lot in art, like painters, especially, I don't know much about art, but, like, I believe, like, a lot of Renaissance painters, they, like, divide up their canvas in two sections where it's like something major is happening in this section, something's happening in this section. It might not be super distinct, but it's there. And the reason they divide it up using this ratio is because for no reason in particular, this is what our eyes like to see. We like to see things that are broken up in this ratio. So a lot of artists know about this thing because they're like, oh yeah, obviously I'm going to use this thing because that's what looks the most pleasing to us. And the ancient Greeks, they would build a lot of their architecture using it because, again, they're like, oh yeah, we know that this is the thing that looks the nicest to us. There's no reason why it should, but it just does. And you know that, what's that famous like drum beat? It's not called like a break beat. It's called, the Amen break. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Oh, it's if you Google it, maybe. Google it later. It's like, it's just like a famous drum beat that a lot of people use. And like the way that those notes are broken up is also in like the golden ratio too. Wow. It's just like random stuff like that. And again, that's what some people will point to and be like, yeah, of course God exists because like, why is this happening? And there's tons of examples like that, but even there's tons of examples like that of things where you can be like, look at this number. Why is it showing up here? I don't know. But in addition to that, like if you look at then like the intricacies of math and you start proving things and you look at how things interlace with each other, you start to find these things where you're like, look, well, why does this have, like, this shouldn't work out this nicely, but it does. And that there's something like really satisfying about that. So that's why math is great. But then also why I specifically like doing math is because like at a lot of these higher level things, it's like you're proving these things. And there's just something so satisfying about a math proof. And let me ask you, Andy, how many more math related questions do you have? Because I want to talk about math a lot.
I got a couple.
Because
Paul, the way that you are lighting up right now in a way that you didn't for the other questions, that was kind of like, of course, this is like what we're going to talk about. And right now you're just like beaming. I love that. It's
Thank
a beautiful
you.
Thing.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful thing.
Because I want to, Andy, can I show you my favorite math thing?
Please.
Okay. I got to get a piece of paper for this. I'm going to try to describe it over audio, but it's my favorite math thing. I'll be right back. All right. You ready, Andy?
Bring it on.
This is my favorite proof in math. And it's a good example of, I think, how awesome math proofs are, because you can prove things that aren't actually tangible. And then also it represents a very common type of proof. So this is called a proof by contradiction.
One eternity later.
And therefore there must be, my assumption is incorrect. I assumed there was a finite number that is incorrect because it causes a contradiction. So there must be an infinite number of primes.
Well, all of that is over my head, but thanks to your excellent teaching skills, I feel like I have a basic grasp of what you're talking about.
And just the last thing.
God bless everyone that made it through that.
Maybe we'll put that in the bloopers at the end. But the reason that I like that proof so much is because it's like you're proving that there's an infinite number of something, which isn't something that I can never say, oh yeah, I'm just going to count all them. And that's how I'm going to show it, because you can't, because there's an infinite number of them. So you're proving something that you could never actually see. And I think that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. When you put it like that, Paul, it's pretty cool.
And the last thing I'm going to say about it is one of my big interests in math is cryptography, which is like the making codes and breaking codes. And specifically it's used in encryption, which if you ever go to, if you ever use the internet, Andy, I don't know if you use the internet ever.
What is that? like a whole other interview.
Yeah, yeah. When you look at the website on the top, there's usually this little green key. This little green lock. Sometimes it's gray. The one I'm looking at right now is gray. But there's this little lock. That means that the website you're on is encrypted, which means whatever you type in, if someone hacked into it, if you put in your password or your credit card information, it runs it through this math equation and just spits out what they would see as just a bunch of nonsense, a bunch of letters and numbers. And the one of the ways that it's encrypted is basically they take really, really, really big numbers, like hundreds of digits long, that only have two prime factors. So it's two prime numbers that are already really big. They multiply them together to get a really, really big number. And the only way to unlock that encryption is to know one of those two prime numbers. And the bank or whoever's using this encryption, they know what those numbers are because they created the other number.
Mm-hmm.
But for even a really fast computer, it would take thousands of years to factor out that big number into its primes, just because it's a slow process. So your information is kept safe because it's just really difficult to factor big numbers into their primes. Yeah. And that's how all your information is kept safe on the internet. That's one of the pieces of it. There's like a lot of other pieces to it, but that's one of the things.
What if someone could hack in and make it look like the encryption thing is on, but it's not actually on? Someone has to figure that out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, so because hacking that way, like, is so right now with the computer speeds we have, is not a good way to do it. Yeah, people try to come up with other ways that to hack into people's stuff. Like, for instance, they'll come up with algorithms, computer programs that just guess common passwords until they get one right. And then if an encryption is not good, if it's encrypted everything the exact same way, and this is actually one of the ways that when, like, you hear Sony got hacked and millions of people got their information leaked and stuff like that, when you hear about these huge data breaches, one of the things that is sometimes the culprit is that Sony or whoever, they get lazy and they use the same encryption on everyone. So Andy, if my password is password and your password is also password, when someone hacks in and they see just this list, they see millions of users and all their encrypted passwords, they'll look at both of ours and they'll say, well, I have no idea what their password is, but it's this exact same nonsense as Andy's. And in fact, there's thousands of people who have that exact same nonsense. So they're like, oh, those people are using a common password. And then they just have a program where they run through really quickly and guess every common password. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And eventually they're probably going to get it. And now they know all of those people's passwords. And that's why you shouldn't use an easy password.
Damn.
Yeah.
Damn. That's wild. I have a password on my lock that I use for the gym. It's a four-letter word, and I feel like anyone that knows anything about the show could guess it eventually.
Is it ska with an exclamation point?
Yes. Amazingly, I found it with an exclamation point in it. The word is rock. As in the rock.
Rock as in the...
So if you want to steal my dirty undies, find me at a Planet Fitness near you. So I dig the explanation. Like it's this beautiful thing. It's everywhere. I feel like also that maybe there's something that might appeal about it is that it's just like logical, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, would you say it's like numbers, like numbers don't lie kind of thing. Like 1 + 1 = 2. Is that not an accurate assessment of numbers?
You use a surprisingly not amount of numbers when you're doing like higher level math, because then it's all just like ideas. In this proof that I just showed you, I didn't actually need to use any numbers. I said, list all the prime numbers. We're going to call them P1, P2, P3, P4, but you're not
sound like numbers to me.
Yeah. You know, you're indexing them. And I used all, like you use all symbols to show things because oftentimes you're trying to prove things that are so, general that you want it to be true for any number. So you can't write a number. That's when you write variables like N or something like that. But to answer your question, yes, it is very logical. And the way you prove things is like, which does sometimes impact when I'm trying to like have arguments in other areas like veganism or something like that. But like the way you prove something in math, it's kind of like, well, I assume it's not true and show why that's false. So it must be true. And that's it. Like, that's all you have to do to show that something is 100% true.
So I guess my question is, if things are supposed to be, things are logical like that and you can prove things, why is some math so hard? Like, I see you doing these problems on like your Instagram stories, or I see like Goodwill Hunting or something where there's just like the gigantic problem and people are writing it out and they can't figure out the solution. And like, I understand that I, as like a lay person, like don't really know the order of operations or how certain things are supposed to work, but it feels like, shouldn't you be able to just like go through and be like, I start here, and like, should there just easily be one answer? Like, why are these problems that it's so hard for people to like figure out how to find the solution for?
I think maybe because, I feel like there's two different answers to that question, because one of them is like, why is math so hard in general for many people? Because a lot of people just don't like math. Like, I'm at the point where when someone's like, oh, what do you do? And I'm like, well, math. And because I expect their answer to be, oh, I hate math. Or like, oh, I was always really bad. A lot of people say like, oh, I was always really bad at math, which is a very common response, to which I always reply, well, yeah, everyone's bad at most things. And then you're good at very few things. And the thing that I happen to be good at or decent at is math. And like, you're great at other stuff that I'm awful at. But I think a lot of people had a bad experience with math early on, maybe in elementary school, middle school, or high school, and that's kind of tainted their perception of math. But so I think that's why a lot of people don't like math or say that they don't get math. I think a lot of people, if they actually sat down and tried to do stuff, especially like high school math stuff, most people, if you went back and tried to do that stuff, you would probably get it, because it is very logical. I will say, however, like I don't want this to sound pretentious at all, but I'm just going to refer to it as higher level math. Like the stuff that you do in college and from then on, it is much more, it gets real abstract. And to be completely honest with you, Andy, it's like when I go and see other people presenting these sorts of things, I usually have no idea what they're talking about, because a lot of things are so, they're so specialized to whatever you're studying, your specific branch of math, because there are so many different branches. And within those branches, there are specific topics. It's so specialized that it's even for other math people, it's hard. You're like, oh yeah, I kind of get the idea. I know what idea they're talking about, but I have no idea what the intricacies that they're talking about, because these are people who, this is their entire life, is they're just studying this one thing that no one knows about, and them and 30 other people around the world are the only people that care to know about this thing. So it's like, it's just so abstract and so hyper specialized that it gets, it's just like impossible for the lay person to understand, let alone, like, it's possible for other math people that are doing different things to understand. That's wild. It is wild. I mean, I imagine it's like that in most very, very specialized content areas. You know, if you went to someone like doing physics and stuff, I'd be like, what the heck?
Maybe even like music. Like, you think like, okay, playing four on the floor on a drum kit is like relatively easy. And then you get to people that are just doing like super weird divisions of notes and things like that. And that it doesn't make it any less like simple or logical, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. But it certainly, I think it just happens to look a lot more confusing than these other things. You know, it's like, I understand how I understand like the physical stuff involved in like playing the drums or something like that. Yeah. I can't do it at all, but it's like, you can look at it and understand what's happening. Even if you're like, acknowledge, I can't do this thing. Or like art, you know, it's like, wow, this art is blowing my mind. You probably don't know all the intricacies of what went into it. You don't know necessarily what this person was going into it, but you can still look at it and you know like what it is. But with like some like math and stuff, you look at it and you're like, what the heck is this? And again, that's not like, I'm not saying any of these other things are easier, because again, there's probably so much stuff that goes into it that you don't see when you see the final product, or at least I don't see because I don't understand it. But it's just something that like, as a culture, we can look at like a painting and be like, this is a painting. But then you look at like all these letters and symbols in your stuff and you're like, this is gibberish, you know?
Yeah. Well, I guess the way that you sort of phrased like what you think the beauty of math is, or part of it, is that it's in everything. And so people look at the ATM machine or the bridge or whatever, and they're not thinking math. They're thinking, look at this form or this technology. So just like people don't realize everything that went into the painting or something like that.
Yeah,
it's just, it's there. Yeah. It's like kind of an interesting tendency to be like, this thing is beautiful. How can I logically explain it and like break down the math of that whole thing? And like, certain people are just like drawn to that.
I agree.
All right. Okay. So we got in relation to math and your studies, we got a question from Brian B on Facebook, which was then sort of backed up by Mohara, who wanted to know the answer as well. Math nerd here. I'd love for Paul to explain his dissertation research.
Well, that is not
a dissertation.
So I know I just spent a lot of time talking about math, so I'm going to very, very, very quickly try to explain like the situation, my current situation, which is I'm about to enter my second year as a grad student and in my program. And it seems like many other math programs, the first 2 years is basically just a master's degree. And then after that, you spend between 2 and 4 additional years after you get your master's degree. And that's when you really pursue your research. So I'm already I've already done like a little bit of researchy type stuff, but nothing that's like, oh, this is the thing that I'm going to be researching for my actual dissertation.
Now, the numbers on the chalkboard.
And so after this upcoming year, I can basically either, assuming I pass this myriad of tests and other hurdles, I can continue in the PhD program, or I can choose to just get my master's degree and leave after that, which, to be honest, is the thing that I am slightly leaning towards at this point for, again, a myriad of reasons. And so I may never do any sort of dissertation. So I'm sorry that I can't answer that question. I guess the best thing I can give you is the research that I did do over this summer, which again had nothing to do with like necessarily what I'm going to be doing in the future, but the research that I was doing, this is going to be a real, I guess, math jargony thing that I'm about to say, but it was asking the question, so tangent, which is like sine over cosine, tangent, the tangent function, is tangent of n greater than n for an infinite number of integers n? And that is the research topic that I looked for. I pursued. I did not come to any sort of conclusion. I guess the conclusion I came to, again, this is all I'm going to say about it, is that if the continued fraction expansion of pi over 2 is unbounded, then the answer is probably yes, there are an infinite number of them. And if it is bounded, which it doesn't seem like it is, then there is a finite number of them. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
So you said that had nothing to do with like what you want to do in the future. What do you want to do in the future in terms of math?
Well, when I was starting to apply to schools and stuff, it is because when I was teaching high school, I had the opportunity to adjunct as an adjunct professor at the University of Hartford and taught a calculus class. And I said, wow, this is great. I could totally see myself doing this. I like, because I liked teaching higher level math, and I was teaching pre-calc and calc in high school, and that's basically the highest you can get to in high school. So I was like, well, if I want to teach higher level than that, I'll need to go back to school and become a professor. So that's kind of what got me thinking I should do that. And then since then, I've kind of been like, oh, maybe I'll get into cybersecurity. Maybe I will really like doing research, and then I'll just go for a professor position. Right now, at this moment, I'm kind of like a little bit itching to get back into an actual workforce, which is one of the reasons why I'm like, huh, maybe I should just do the master's degree and leave after that, because the idea of doing this for 4 or 5 more years doesn't sound the most appealing to me. But right now I'm kind of like, oh, maybe I can get into some sort of data science type thing, which is basically just using different sort of analytical methods to look at data for any sort of organization or company or any sort of data, and then using that data and those methods to kind of advise what the company or organization should do next. And specifically, because that's kind of what the way that organizations and companies are moving towards. Specifically, I'm hoping to maybe get into that with in terms of some sort of animal rights organization, because I imagine there are very few people doing that at the moment. So that's what I'm looking for right now, is something where I can like look at data and use that data to advise what people should do next. And it's a little bit more than just basic statistics stuff or surveying people. It's using these different methods.
And you mentioned teaching. So when we first started recording, I believe that's when you were teaching high school level.
Yes.
I feel like it would be terrifying to teach in high school. Like, what was your experience like?
Well, I will say the thing that made me realize like maybe I shouldn't be a teacher. Well, also, it's like I went to college right out of high school, and I started teaching right after I got a master's degree in education from UConn. So I started teaching when I was, 22 or 23. So maybe if I went back now, it would be different. I'm a different person now than I was whatever 5 years ago. But the thing that was like, oh, I don't know if teaching is the long-term thing for me, is because I did not like the classroom behavior management aspect of it, which is what I feel like that this question is kind of getting at. I'm sure you're not like, oh, how could I teach? Like, you're not asking me how it was difficult to teach math specifically. You're asking about like,
I mean, I guess for me, whenever I see high school boys, I assume they're about to beat me up.
Well,
they're terrifying.
So
they're lawless vandals.
So the classroom behavior management was the aspect where I was like, oh, like I just don't like doing it. I didn't like having to be super strict and having to be like, sit down and like, don't talk anymore. Like, I don't like doing that.
In that voice specifically.
In that voice. I yelled once as a high school teacher. I yelled one time.
Please tell me all about that.
And it wasn't actually even in one of my classes. I was covering for another teacher that taught a freshman class. I didn't have any freshmen because I was teaching pre-calc and calc, thank goodness, because they are the lawless ones. And I was subbing, I was covering for a teacher, so I didn't know any of these kids, and they're acting like wild. And I just yelled at one point. I was just like, sit down,
Damn.
but it like very loud.
I hope you did it in your continuous improvement voice.
Oh, I mean, it was like a yelling.
Yeah.
But that's the only time I ever yelled, because like right from the get-go, I kind of tried to be, because I knew it's not me to be stern or mean or anything like that. Not that teachers can be strict. Like, I think it's different. There's different things, being strict and mean. Like, that's not, they're not the same thing at all, and they don't need to overlap at all. But I was certainly of the idea, like, I'm going to respect these kids and they are going to respect me back. And that's like, that's going to be that is this classroom. Like, when you come to this classroom, it's like, I'm going to show you this respect. So I expect you to show me respect back. And I would say largely it worked, and I fostered so many wonderful relationships. And that's the thing that I miss about teaching the most, is I made I met so many awesome kids that were doing so many cool things. And at the time, it's like, they're all figuring out who they are. They're figuring out what they're doing with their life. They're figuring out all these things about themselves. And I got to be a part of that process of them like growing into real people with real identities and unique identities. And it was like, it was amazing. And there are so many kids, and it's like, you know, I feel like every parent is going to be like, oh, I don't have any favorites. It's like, I certainly had favorite kids or kids that I was like, wow, I really miss seeing those kids. And there were kids that challenged me about stuff.
Name them.
but you know, it's just like, there are so many awesome individuals, and that's the thing that I miss teaching. That's the thing about teaching I miss the most.
Well, Paul, in my deep digging for this review, I did find you're listed on ratemyprofessor.com. And there's only one review for you. Okay. And the person described you as energetic and easily understandable.
That's good.
For some reason, didn't talk about your great reading voice. But it looks like there's like little badges that you can get awarded. Like Uber drivers can get like good conversation, yeah, or clean car or whatever. And you were awarded a badge for respected.
Oh, that's good. So I'm glad. That makes me feel good.
Respect was given and received.
That's really good. You know, it's like, I mean, these kids, it's like it's funny because it's like, they are just kids and they like goof off and they talk about inappropriate things sometimes, which is sometimes funny. And I still had to be like, no, you can't talk about that, even though what you're saying is hilarious. But it's like, it was just so great to have these like real conversations with these people, because you're like, wow, these are like human beings that are growing into adults and they're going to be in the world. And it's like, it was just cool. It was really awesome. I miss that.
Mm-hmm. Professor Paul Steller. I feel like anyone would be lucky to have you as a teacher.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
The way that you were talking about math would be like, it's so different than any high school like math teacher that I had for the most part, like the way they talked about math, like it did make it feel like it was a chore. And like almost like punishment that you had to do, as opposed to like it felt like they were just slogging to get through the day as much as you were. So,
yeah. And also I will say about the, I don't know if we've edited out my big math proof that I told you, Andy, but that was very rushed. And I feel like I would be better at explaining it if I wasn't like, I got to get through this as quickly as possible.
I think people can probably find that in the bloopers section. All right, so I want to change the topic like almost entirely.
Okay, that's fun.
So there's two words that I would associate with you that are like your brand.
Can I guess what they are?
Sure.
It's one of them, pizza.
Uh-huh.
And Andrew WK.
No, Andrew WK is more than one word, but you got the first one. Both of them are in your Instagram name, Stay Pizzative. Pizza and positive.
Okay.
So I guess I want to ask you about, because like I feel like on our show, we are we're in the same genre, you and I, in terms of like how we think about issues, but we like diverge in maybe like you are much more positive and like hopeful and optimistic person, less of a burnt out husk of a man than I am. Your heart is not cold and dead like mine. And so I guess I want to talk to you about positivity. Like because your positivity, there's like fake positivity culture out there. This mm-hmm. just like everything is always great and it's all your mindset. And if things are bad, you just have to shift your mindset and it's your fault, like whatever. Like you, that's not the positivity that you sort of ascribe to. Do you have a PMA tattoo?
I have two.
Two positive mental attitude tattoos. So I don't know, like, can you tell me about like, how did that become like your... I know this is said like facetiously, but like your personal brand, yeah, like what about that resonates with you?
I think that when I was younger, like in high school and then maybe early college, I would say it wasn't like the fake positivity that you were talking about, but I think it had like, I don't think that's what I meant it to be, but I think it had aspects of that, which was just like, oh, we should be happy all the time. Like I'm going to be happy all the time. And I think, yeah, I think like I had aspects of exuding that type of attitude occasionally, when I was younger, but I think it's because I mentioned, it's like, I feel like I've grown up in a very privileged position. So I've kind of always thought it's like, well, it's like, I'm, I don't have a lot of things to complain about, so I'm going to try not to complain about these things, and I'm going to, like, I'm just going to try to exude this presence that's like a happy thing and something that people can be happy about. And Andy, I don't know if you're going to ask me any questions about Andrew WK, but Andrew WK being my favorite musician, like, I think Andrew WK also exudes aspects, don't tell him I said this, of that, like, fake positivity, not in the sense that I think he is that person, because I don't think that he is, but I think in some of the things he says, it's promoting that kind of philosophy. That's like, some of the things is like, oh, we should be, oh, you're having a bad day. Well, just be happy. Like, why can't you just be happy about it? Or like, you got to be positive to get through things. And because Andrew WK was a big influence on me, I feel like that's probably why I do have some of those aspects, but it's like, I think over time, and I think also I did cognitive behavioral therapy for a while, and that also helped me. And that person actually that I did that therapy with was actually very against, like, any sort of positive attitude, which sounds weird to say, but, and I disagreed with this person about a lot of things in terms of that, but they were always like, oh, don't be positive, be rational. That was kind of like their mantra. And so for a while I was like, oh, I've never thought about this before. It's like, and for a while I switched to that where I was like, oh yeah, I'm not going to be all about being positive. I'm going to be all about being rational. And in terms of like, because rationally, like, you are not going to be happy all the time, and you're going to have to deal with stuff, and you're going to have to deal with situations happening to you. But then also you're just going to have to deal with not being happy sometimes for no reason other than you're just not happy at that moment. And it's irrational to think that anyone is going to be happy all the time. So for a while I was like really all about that. And now I think I found this good in between where it's like, I want to do things that are constructive, and I want to promote this attitude of like being constructive. And it's like, I'm in this position where it's like, I'm able to do some things and hopefully help to change some things there's a lot of terrible stuff happening in the world. And I'm in this position where I can hopefully be constructive about promoting change in some of those things. And I feel like that's a rational and constructive thing to do. I'm not going to just say, oh, well, everything's great, because everything is terrible in the world and everything is not good. But also I feel like being 100% rational is kind of not letting one of the big things I disagreed with this therapist was like, he didn't say, he wasn't promoting like, oh, you should be a robot, like an emotionless robot, but he was very into like, you don't need to like, subscribe to any sort of like emotional response. And I think that there's like a good mix between those things. So I feel like right now back when I was first doing the positive thing, I was like, this is the way to do it. I figured it out. When I was doing the rational thing, I said, this is the way to do it. I figured it out. So now I'm like, oh, I figured it out. You know, it's like in 4 years, I'll probably have I'll grow into some other, philosophy, or my philosophy will change a little bit, or I'll adapt to different things. But does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, I'm just imagining you with a totally different Instagram handle. Stay rational.
Stay rational.
So now I guess did you say it's safe to say that you have moments in your life when you're just straight up not positive? Or is it like always there? Is it something you have to force ever?
Yeah, I think, I think especially, I will say, without getting too deep into it, like especially my first school year, last year, had many moments for many different reasons that put me in like a not so great place. And I was most definitely not positive, for the majority of the periods of time. But, I think, and I will also say something that I am currently trying to work on, Andy, is not being as much of a, like a people pleaser that a negative way. Like, I think, you know, it's like, obviously I want to help other people out. I want to be kind to other people and do things for other people because I love helping other people. But I need to, something that I do need to work on is like not letting that always take precedent over the things that I need as well. Like being able to have relationships where it's like, oh, well, I can say what I need as well. And those things are respected too, instead of always just disregarding those things. And I think, you know, part of that maybe in my past was like, even when I was not feeling great, I would kind of, because I don't want to negatively impact other people, I would like not express those things all the time. And I mean, last year it was like, there were points where I was feeling, not great, to the point where I was like, oh, like I don't even have the energy to pretend that I'm like happy about these things. But now I feel like I'm at this point where I'm working on being able to express those things and constructively express how I'm feeling to other people in a way where it's like, if someone's asking me to do something, expressing like, it's like, I can't do this thing right now. And it's not because I don't want to, it's not because I don't want to help you out, but it's just like, I can't do this for me. I don't remember what your original question was, but it was something like, what was your question?
I mean, I was just asking about like moments in your life when you weren't feeling positive or
yeah,
if you ever had to force it or just be like, fuck it, I'm not positive right now. Like, this sucks.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are definitely moments where I was like, yeah, this sucks, but I think I still, I don't know. I maybe this is the people pleaser thing, but I still try not to, you know, bring other people down too. But sometimes it's just like, wow, I feel so bad that it's like, there's no way I can express this to you without you also being like, wow, geez, that does really suck. And like, now I feel bad too.
Do you feel like you have a healthy outlet to like express when you're feeling like depressed or down or unhappy with life?
I think I'm working on it. I think traditionally, historically I've been not as great at like expressing those things. I think Andy relatively recently, like last year or something, one time I expressed something to you because I was like actively trying to work on something. And I remember you were like, why are you telling me this? Like, cause you thought I was telling you it for like a specific reason, because historically I would not share something like this to you. Yeah. And so I was just funny to me because I really threw you off, but it was really, I was like, oh, I'm telling you this because I'm trying to be better about like telling my friends these things, you know?
I don't remember that specific incident. like I thought you were leading up to being like, so I can't record this week or like something like that.
No. It was like a relationship thing where I was like, Andy, I'm like, this is a thing that happened and I'm feeling this way. And you were like, and you were just like thrown off about like, oh, do you like, are you telling me this because you want me to say this specific thing about it? And I was like, no, I'm just telling you because I want to tell you this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I do feel like that is probably like, for as close as we are, that is something that we could probably both work on, is like expressing those. I think we've gotten a lot better at that of like, even just like talking about like what's going on in our relationships and like stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, and it's certainly not you. It's like, I just haven't been good at this stuff. And yeah, I'm trying to be better. We're all trying to be better.
Indeed. All right. Well, I have a couple of random questions.
Okay.
Paul.
Yes.
Bodybuilding, going to the gym.
Yes.
Why do you get up so early?
This morning I woke up, Andy is staying at my place, and I woke him up because I woke up at 5:30 to go to the gym. Unfortunately, I heard he could not fall back asleep, so I'm sorry about that, Andy.
Can confirm. I knew what I was getting into by staying here.
So once I'm up and doing something, there's a few reasons I get up so early. Once I'm up and doing something, I feel like I don't get tired until, even if I'm getting up at 5:30, I don't start to get tired if I'm like sitting in class or something until like 3 or 4, and then usually drinking coffee helps me with that. But I am much more productive in the morning than I am in the evening. So if I went to school and did all my school stuff and then was like, oh, now I need to go to the gym at 6 o'clock, I would be very unmotivated to do that. That's one reason. Another reason is, I think I like going to the gym as the first thing that I do. I feel like, something we've talked about on the podcast, Like, it's something that I feel like I have control over, in especially going to school now, in a plethora of things that I feel like I have no control over. It's nice to have this one thing where I'm like, I can get up and do this thing, and I'm starting my day doing this, and it like kind of sets the tone of the day where it's, I've already done this productive thing, and it's something that I'm choosing to do that I don't have to do, but I'm like, I have control on over this thing. And literally sometimes it feels like this is the only thing that I have control over. And so it's like, I really grasp onto that. But if I didn't get up so early, then it would just push my whole day back. And the further the day goes on, I'm just, after like 4 o'clock, I'm just not that productive. And so when it starts to get late and I'm not productive, if I've started my day late, then I just don't get as much done. So for right now, when I'm studying for these exams, it's like, even getting up at 5:30 after I work out, get home, shower, eat and stuff like that, and then bike to school, I don't get to my office till like 10 a.m. And so I feel like I'm still not starting my day as early as I could be starting my day. Good but Lord. I don't really want to wake up much earlier than 5:30.
Why even go to bed at all, Paul? Yeah, you know, that's to make it all about me. Mm-hmm. There was a period in my life when I was living with a roommate, and we were a block away from our friend Josh that we've mentioned on the show many times. And we would all go to the gym at 6 a.m. like multiple days per week, even when it was like, you know, ridiculously freezing cold out.
Yeah.
And we're just we're not going to go change at the gym. So we'd be like in our shorts waiting for Josh to pick us up and like run outside and the car is still cold because he's a block away. And there was something really satisfying about like by 9 a.m. I would have gone to the gym, you know, obviously worked out, showered, made breakfast, and like even answered some emails or done some writing. And it's like 9 o'clock when I normally would like be waking up and getting out of bed. There was something really satisfying about that. I have switched now where like I love going to the gym at like 11 o'clock at night.
Really?
I love that nice, like quiet late night gym.
Well, let me tell you something, Andy. At 6 o'clock in the morning, not too many people at the gym either.
There's probably too much like optimism at 6 a.m. though. Everyone at 11 is like beaten down. It's like, guess I'll do this.
I'm just not a night person at all.
Yeah.
Like, and also sleeping in too much also stresses me out.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I could have done so many things and I slept until noon.
I feel that. I loved it whenever I go to like California, I'm driving there. So it's like a slow enough transition where it's not super jarring to my senses to be changed off the time zone, but still quick enough where I'm kind of waking up at my normal time. So I'm just like waking up at 6 a.m. and feeling fine about it.
Yeah.
At least for like a month or two and feeling like so productive. Like I'm getting so much done.
Yeah. That's funny.
Okay. A question that we got asked from Jules Inkwell on Instagram, which I feel like could be a main episode question, because we're likely going to answer more podcast kind of questions in the episode 200. But I also feel like the answer is maybe boring enough that we should just answer it individually in our own interviews. Jules, not that it's a boring question, but I just feel like anyone that's listening to these will be much more interested in the answer.
Yeah.
Which is, what is your soundtrack for Saving the Animals? Which I just take to mean, what music do you like?
Yeah. Well,
give me like a top five.
Oh, this is tough.
Top 10.
I mean, number one, Andrew WK, hands down, love him. Can't get enough of him. I think right now is August 12th, 2019, listening to a lot of like folk punky and ska and punk ska.
Folk ska.
But like, I don't know. My Spotify, I feel like, has been perfectly curated at this point where it makes my daily lists, and I got one that's punk ska, I got one that's hardcore, and I got one that's new metal. And then I also have a Hamilton one too, because I listen to Hamilton so much, the Hamilton soundtrack. But
is it all just songs from Hamilton?
It is. So I never actually listened to the daily one. I don't listen to that podcast. I just go through and listen to the actual Hamilton thing. But I would say I'm just gonna look at my Spotify right now. I'll give you what my top songs are. In my hardcore list, we got like Blacklisted and Trapped Under Ice and Have Heart and You're the Knife, my Delaware crew, and Trash Talk, those sorts of bands, typical hardcore bands. My punk folky ska thing is like Kid Dynamite, The Lawrence Arms, Off Their Heads, The Lillingtons, Rancid, Voodoo Glow Skulls, Anti-Flag, Less Than Jake, those sorts of things. And then my new metal is, of course, Korn, Disturbed, Hatebreed, and Slipknot.
Disturbed, really?
Yeah, I like Disturbed.
Even for new metal, Paul. never could get into them.
So, yeah, but Andrew WK tops them all, always.
The soundtrack that's playing in your head 24/7.
Yep. Also, the Flaming Tsunamis.
You know, it's funny because I also have like my hardcore daily mix, which is a lot of like Year of the Knife type, Trail of Lies.
Tough guy hardcore.
Tough guy. The stuff I listen to at the gym.
Yeah.
Why am I totally... Harm's Way.
Yeah.
It's like super big on that one. But then I have like, there's like a reggae and like dub daily mix and then the ska punk one. But because my band is often put in there, it's, I like can't listen to that.
Aww.
But it's really weird because it'll put like stuff from our last album where there's literally no ska punk to be found on it. So it'll be like all these like upbeat third wave songs and then it'll be like some like transition track that's a diatribe about like why the US deserved 9/11 or something. And then back into like ska punk and you're like, that's a weird transition.
I'll say this, Andy, since the question was specifically soundtrack to save animals, Thalidomide by the Flaming Tsunamis is my favorite animal rights related song.
You know, since this is a bonus, maybe we could put that as the outro music.
And since you own the music, question mark?
I guess, I don't know, I'm certainly not making money off of it.
But no, that is not joking, that is my favorite animal rights related song. Not that there's, you know, not that that's like a, no, I guess like Earth Crisis could have been it, or there's that Goldfinger song.
Yeah.
Behind the Mask.
All right. I'll put that whole song as the outro.
Yes.
All right. My favorite part about that song is the parts where I'm not singing.
Which is many, I would say, in that song. Which is many.
A lot of guest vocals. Okay. All right. So that's the soundtrack to Saving Animals. I think we can, I got a couple fun ones. Hopefully it'll wrap it up.
Okay.
What's the deal with tofu? Food, like, it's not that you, my impression is it's not that you don't enjoy like seasoning and flavor and fun food.
Yeah.
But it's not something that you seem to really bring into your home. Like, food is almost this like really utilitarian thing where you're like, I'm just gonna eat a can of chickpeas and like a thing of tofu.
Yeah.
What's the deal?
I think that is hitting the nail on the head, that since cooking for many people is like an enjoyable process, and it just isn't for me. I don't like cooking, and I want to minimize the amount of cooking that I have to do. So my cooking, if you could call it that, is very utilitarian, and I just make I know, like, I'm like, okay, I need this much amount of this many grams of protein, this many grams of carbs, this many grams of fat. And I figured out how to get those things. And that's what I do. And with slight variation, I just like eat the same thing, or I eat the same rotation of things every single day, which is, usually a smoothie that does have tofu in it. I haven't done the raw. It's a smoothie with raw tofu in it, so I guess that is still raw tofu. And I'm also using the super firm tofu, which like doesn't really get blended up very well in it. So it's chunky. Which, okay, very quick side story. I did this, and especially it's great for school because I can just make a smoothie and I would put it in these mason jars, and it's just this gross chunky green smoothie because there's a lot of kale in it. Not a lot of flavor. I'll be like, oh, I can put half a banana into this smoothie that is just full of a full block of tofu and like a whole bundle of kale. And it's green and gross. And my blender also is not that great. So there's like chunks of kale and tofu and stuff. And one of my classes ended, and then I would have this happened every single week. I would have 15 minutes to bike across campus to teach to TA at a class that was on like the third floor. And I had exactly 15 minutes between classes, and the professor of my class would often go over time. So I'd always be like ready to go, and then I'd just run out. And this one particular day, I like grabbed my bag to go out, my mason jar of smoothie fell out of my bag and just shattered all over the classroom floor. No. And this like puke green chunky
chunky
smoothie and shards of glass just went all over the floor, and I was like, oh my god. And I just like cleaned it up as quickly as possible. Kids were coming in for the next class and I was like, it's not throw up, it's just a gross smoothie.
Eating the glass, trying to hide it.
And I made it to my class that night. That was 15 minutes later. that I had to teach, but damn, it was disgusting.
Tell me about the big tree.
So the, if you've done driving, I guess.
Do you do driving?
You may have passed. You might be a big tree if you've done driving. You know, you might be a redneck. Those, whatever, Andy.
I get it. I just don't approve.
So there's those big cell towers that for some reason that are probably three or four times all of the height of the trees around them. But for some reason, they still try to disguise as big trees, fooling no one, but there'll be like branches on them. And some are better quality than the others. Some are just like, it looks worse. It's like, why are you bringing attention to this thing that is just like, yes, I drive by these big antennas and towers and stuff. It's not out of the ordinary, but then all of a sudden you're driving by this thing that's like, it's just supposed to look like a tree, but it's five times the size of every other tree. So there's specifically one, I think it's on the Hutchinson Parkway, that I always pass on. It's in New York. I always pass on my drive back to Connecticut. And it's just like, it just became a silly thing that I would take a picture of it and be like, the big tree. And I would post about it. And then recently I was like, I might as well just post like really political stuff along with it. So I'd be like, the big tree says, and then it'll just be some really politically charged comment. And so now I've started, I don't know, it's just the big tree.
It's great.
Thank you.
One time I mentioned how it's unsafe to take those photos. And I was thinking it'd be a great band name to have a band called Big Tree Death Cult. Although now you often stop at the rest stop, only once, take a safe photo.
Only once or twice I took like a picture while I was driving, but usually I stop at the rest stop and take the pictures.
Yeah, we all appreciate that, Paul. Okay. Why don't you put toilet paper on the correct way?
I stand firm. So Andy has, I don't even think about it. I just put it on some way and Andy always tells me it's the wrong way. And then one time he like sent me a diagram. It's like, this is the patent of the of the toilet paper. And look, if you look at the patent, it's going in this way. But I stand firm that like, if you just had like, think about it this way. You know how most toilet paper rolls, yes, they're attached to the wall, but sometimes you get those ones where it's like a freestanding thing where it's just like two bars going up and then the bar going across and the toilet paper's in that bar. If you put a toilet paper in a certain way and then you just literally turned around the entire device, you've still put in the toilet paper the same way, but now it's facing the other direction. And for some reason that makes things different. And I say, no, it doesn't make things any different.
You could sit like backwards in a movie theater and you're facing the wrong way and you're doing it the incorrect way, Paul.
But I don't know. I just feel like it's a matter of perspective and you're just unwilling to see it from the opposite perspective. And that's why you think I put toilet paper on the wrong way. Did you just think of that question as you used my
pattern? No, I literally wrote that question down. I definitely Instagram shamed you one time.
One time.
Maybe more than that. Yes. Many times, multiple times. All right. The last question I want to ask is the last question that gets asked on the You Made It Weird podcast. Because I love this question. Can you remember the time in your life that you laughed the hardest?
I mean, I want to say the answer is no. I cannot remember the time, but now I got to think.
Recall a time. In which it's a hard question. Guests often don't have an answer right away, and I'm not sure if I would have an answer right away, but it's not my interview. I'm not being interviewed, so you have to answer.
God, I feel like there was a movie. I'll say this. I feel like there's a movie recently or something that I saw recently where I was like, I laughed almost the whole time, or show or podcast. I'm just throwing
out. Was it the entire 24 hour long Comedy Bang Bang podcast?
No, I feel like I'm like 10 hours, Andy. I feel like I'm like being one of those psychic people who are trying to like pan the crowd and be like, oh, it was a movie or a TV show or a podcast. And someone's like, I have a podcast. Yes, that was it. I'm speaking to your podcast now. John Edwards. Oh man. We talked about What We Do in the Shadows yesterday, Andy.
Yes.
That movie, I think, is one of the funniest movies that I've ever seen.
That line I was talking about was definitely one of the funniest lines I've ever heard in a movie.
But
what's the line? It's a mystery.
I feel like I really like this podcast, My Brother and Me, and the titular brothers on the show. They just have this like really this dynamic that suits perfectly to my style of comedy, and they put out a lot of other content as well. And one of the things they do is this, it's called Monster Factory. It's a YouTube series where they basically, it's two of them that they play these video games that have a lot of capabilities of like character creation, like making the character look, you know, like a lot of games, you're like, oh, you can make the character like The Sims. You can make the character look like you. But now since games have advanced, you know, it's like you can change like the position of the person's ear, like you can change every single thing. And they go on these games and they try to make like the grossest looking person of all time, and they're already very funny. And that when I watch those, I think that might be the hardest that I laugh is when I watch those videos. I enjoy those a lot.
That's delightful. All right, Paul, well, I wanted to wrap up this interview by giving you a gift.
Yeah. I don't have a gift for Andy.
Sucker, that's why I went first. Make you look bad in our interview. So I know you say that you don't cook, but I do know that you make a mean eggplant parm.
That is true.
And I have heard you say that you have cooked things out of the super fun Happy Time holiday cookbook or whatever.
Yes.
And I brought up a cookbook on the show recently, and you're like, I would make everything out of that. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to hold you to that. And I'm giving you a copy of Epic Vegan.
Oh my gosh.
Which I purchased at VMark's the shop.
Oh, thank you.
So now I hope to see you making stuff. So that's a friendship gift and just a happy 2 year or 4 years gift. Happy 200 episode gift coming up soon. As I don't know if we're going to record that one together or not. And then Paul.
Oh my gosh. Oh no.
When you inevitably don't make anything out of that.
Andy has given me two cans of Loma Linda Big Friends, which are incredible, incredible canned hot dogs.
Also purchased at VMark's the shop. Shout out.
Hot dogs and water. Oh, I love it. These are so good. Thank you.
I hope you drink that water or put it in your smoothie.
Maybe I'll discover that this is the new aquafaba. Like hot dog water is actually the thing that vegans were missing. Andy, you're the best. And I love you.
Paul. I love you. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
You know, Andy, these are great gifts that you gave me, but the greatest gift that you can give me is for me to finally hear you say the following seven words.
We are the Bearded Vegans, signing off.
So commonly, the animal abuser in laboratories will frame the question of, do you want us to help your child or do you want us to stop experimenting on animals? Well, that is a false question. That's not what it is. And in fact, if these animal experimenters would quit wasting money on this needless and useless animal research, they could actually save a lot more people.
And it's a good example of, I think, how awesome math proofs are, because you can prove things that aren't actually tangible. And then also it represents a very common type of proof. So this is called a proof by contradiction, which basically means I'm going to assume the thing that I'm trying to prove is not true and then show why that can't be possible.
I'm on board.
Okay. So I'm going to prove to you why there's an infinite number of prime numbers. Okay. So are you familiar with prime numbers? Basically, every number can either be, you can factor it out. So for instance, the number 10 can be factored out into its primes, which is 2 times 5. But 2 and 5 can't be factored out anymore. They're only divisible by the number 1 and themselves. So 2 and 5 are prime numbers. And every number that's not prime is called composite.
I never knew that.
Yes. So for instance, 12 is a composite number because I can break down 12 into 2 times 6, and then 6 I can break down into 2 times 3. So it has prime numbers, prime factors 2, 2, and 3. All right. Okay. Now, to prove that there's an infinite number of prime numbers, I'm going to assume that there's not an infinite number of prime numbers. So there's a finite number, which means there must be a biggest prime number, right?
But don't numbers just go on forever?
Numbers go on forever, but I'm going to prove that there's an infinite number of prime numbers.
Okay.
So for instance, the prime numbers, 1, we don't consider a prime number. So prime numbers start 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, they get more sparse as they go out. Except there's
kind
actually
kind of like a golden spiral.
Kind of like a golden spiral, except they're actually, that's actually technically not true, because there's an also, I'm not going to prove this, there's an infinite number of twin primes as well, which are prime numbers that are directly next to each other. No, sorry, like 5 and 7. Huh. Obviously, even numbers can't be prime because they're going to be divisible by 2, but 5 and 7 are twin primes, and there's an infinite number of them. So they actually don't get infinitely sparse, but it is harder to get to them, because you're like, okay, if I have a number that's 100 digits long, like it must be divisible by some other number before it, you know.
Yeah.
But if there's an infinite number, that means you can always find a number that's larger than that that's mm-hmm. going to be prime. So I'm going to assume that there's a finite number, which means I can list them all out, right? So for instance, instead of writing them all out, I'm just going to write P1, that's the first prime number, and then P2, that's the second prime number, P3, that's the third prime number, and let's say I'm going to go all the way up to, let's say there's N number, where n is just some number. There's n number of primes. So I've listed them all out for you. P1, P2, P3, all the way to Pn, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to create a new number that's, I'll call it big N, capital N. And that big N number is P1 times P2 times P3 times all the way up to Pn, and then +1 after that. Now, Andy, let me ask you, if I take my list of prime numbers, all of them, and I multiply them all by each other, I'm going to get a pretty big number, right?
I think so.
And then I'm adding 1 to that. So that's a pretty big number. Would you agree that that number that I've just created should be bigger than all of the other numbers that I've listed out, all the prime numbers I've listed out?
I would assume so.
Yes, right? So it's bigger than all the primes I've listed out. And because I said, okay, well, Pn is my largest prime, and I've created a number that's bigger than that, this new number I've created must be composite then, right?
I don't know.
if I only have a finite number of primes, mm-hmm. and I've listed them all out, and I create a number that's bigger than that, well, it can't be prime because I already listed all those out.
Ah.
It's bigger than that, so it must be not prime.
Gotcha.
It must be composite.
Gotcha. Understood.
And if a number is composite, then it has some prime. I can divide it by some other prime number. It can mm-hmm. be broken down into its primes. And let's just assume, for ease, let's just assume that P2 is the prime number that I can divide it by. So that's, if I take this number N and I divide it by P2, it'll give me some other whole number, right? Like the number 10, if I divide it by 2, one of its primes, I get another whole number, 5. So I take N divided by 2 and I get some whole number. So I'm just going to write whole number. Whole number. But if I divide this side by P2, that means I should be able to divide all this other stuff by P2. P2. Well, you might remember from, I don't know, elementary school or something like that, or maybe high school. But if I have a fraction that looks something like A plus B divided by 2, I can break that up into A divided by 2 plus B divided by 2.
Mm-hmm.
You can break up a fraction like that. And so I have my list P1 times P2 times P3 all the way through PN, divide that by 2. Well, that'll certainly divide by 2 because P2 is in the numerator as well. P2 divided by P2, those will just cancel each other out, right? So that's fine. That's a whole, that list clearly is divisible. But I also have this plus 1 divided by P2. And 1 divided by P2 is definitely going to be a fraction, right? Mm-hmm. It's just 1 over some other number, P2.
Yeah.
So now I have a whole number plus a fraction equaling a whole number. And that can't happen, Andy. I can't have just a whole number and then add it to a fraction and get another whole number. That can't happen. So that is my contradiction. That is a contradiction.
Paul's writing down the word contradiction.
He's underlining it.